Hear ye. The headlines tonight. Schooner shocker sinks Milwaukee. Mexico Metro mayhem. Massive manslaughter. Poland pioneers papery proclamation. Plus, coming up, Queen abdicates after knighting horse. Wafispan duikis. Those were the headlines. Time to tune in or turn off.
Dies Dresd, Tues Bang, the beacon of brilliance in the babbling brooks of Balderdash. 1845.
On this day in 1845, the Milwaukee Bridge War erupted, a conflict as cheesy as the state it was fought in. It all started with a schooner ramming into a bridge, because why not? The east side, led by Solomon Juno, and the west side, led by Byron Kilbourne, had been butting heads over who had the best bratwursts and the finest cheeseheads.
The west siders, fed up with Juno's bratty behaviour, decided to teach him a lesson by dismantling the bridge. East siders responded by shooting off their mouths and their muskets. In the ensuing skirmish, curds flew and beer barrels were smashed. The whole thing was a complete brattle.
Finally, sanity cheddared in when both sides realised they were all American citizens. They rebuilt the bridges and ensured free passage over the Milwaukee River. The Stilton of this tale. Infrastructure is great, but cooperation is cheese grater.
Today, Milwaukee remembers this event with historical markers and a cheesy grin. So next time you're in Wisconsin, raise a glass of Pabst Blue Ribbon and remember, sometimes it takes a bridge war to realise that life's too short to be blithering over bridges.
2021.
On this day in 2021, tragedy struck Mexico City as a metro train plummeted to the ground like a depressed pigeon. The cause? A faulty overpass, more rickety than Boris Johnson's moral compass. The structure, built by Mexi Cowboys Lelty Teed, had more gaps than a Swiss cheese factory's staff room.
As the train hurtled around a corner, the overpass went, hasta la vista, baby, sending commuters on a one-way trip to the underworld. 26 people were sent to meet their maker, while 79 others were left wishing they'd taken the stairs.
Experts blamed shoddy construction, a design flaw straight out of Escher's nightmare, and maintenance so poor it made Boris Johnson look organised.
Political point scoring was to blame, as then-Mayor Ebrard rushed the lines opening for a photo op. His response? I was drunk on power, sue me.
Oh, Breton. 1791.
In 1791, the great Sejm of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, in a fit of enlightenment-induced enlightenment, ratified the Constitution of 3 May 1791. This groundbreaking document, as thick as a telephone directory, aimed to modernize the state and establish a tripartite system of checks and balances. Gone was the Liberum veto, which had previously allowed any same member to nullify legislation and claim my veto trumps your law.
The Constitution was as progressive as a hipster in Shoreditch. It sought to liberate serfs, improve the economy, and enshrine rights like property ownership, fair trials, and education for all. In short, it was like a European Union before the Euro.
Alas, just as the ink dried on parchment, neighbouring powers Poland-sized on the opportunity to partition the Commonwealth. The Constitution's brief existence lasted longer than a celebrity marriage, but its legacy endures. It's a symbol of Polish aspirations for sovereignty and democratic governance, a beacon of hope that one day they too may have an unworkable political system just like ours.
Now this news bang, unmasking the pantomime of yesterday's tomorrow today.
And now, a weather report that promises to be as eccentric as the skies themselves. Taking the reins is none other than Shakanaka Giles, whose colourful forecasts have become the stuff of legend. Let's see what madcap meteorological musings he has in store for us today.
All right, let's get to it, weather watchers. Down in the south, we've got a bit of a rumble brewing, like the grumbling of a disgruntled giant. Expect a few tremors, nothing too serious, but enough to make the teacups rattle. Might want to keep a firm grip on your biscuits, just in case. Up north, we're in for a real twister of a time. Winds so fierce, they'll have you clinging to your hats like a newlywed bride. And if that's not enough, we've got a spot of rain on the way, the kind that'll have you running for cover quicker than a cat in a thunderstorm. As for the Midlands, well, it's going to be a scorcher. Hotter than a sizzling sausage on a summer's day. Best keep the sun cream handy, lest you end up looking like a well-done roast. In summary then, shaky teacups, whirling winds, and a sizzling sausage fest. Sounds like a right old mix-up, if you ask me. And that's all the weather.
Dean, 1920.
In a brazen act that has sent shockwaves through the very fabric of global diplomacy, the Bolsheviks, led by the indomitable Vladimir Lenin, have attempted a coup d'etat in the Democratic Republic of Georgia. This daring manoeuvre, a veritable gauntlet thrown at the feet of the moderate, multi-party political system led by the Georgian Social Democratic Party, has left the world holding its collective breath. On the fateful night of May 2, 1920, a group of Bolshevik fighters, their resolve as steely as the bayonets they wielded, launched a daring assault on the Tiflis Military College, where the esteemed Georgian commander-in-chief, General Georgi Kvinitadze, stood resolute. The cadets and Kvinitadze, their valor matched only by their unwavering commitment to the cause, resisted the attack with every fibre of their being, resulting in casualties among the assailants. And for more on this developing story, we go now to our war correspondent, Brian Bastable, who is embedded with the Georgian forces in Tiflis. Brian, what's the latest from the front lines?
I'm reporting live from the blood-soaked streets of Tiflis, where the very fabric of the Democratic Republic of Georgia is being torn asunder by the Bolsheviks' iron grip. The air reeks of smoke, sweat, and desperation as the Red Army tightens its noose around the beleaguered nation. Before me, the once proud buildings of the Georgian government lie in ruins, their walls pockmarked with bullet holes, their windows shattered, their doors hanging limply from their hinges like the broken dreams of a nation. The streets are awash with the bodies of the fallen, their limbs twisted at impossible angles, their eyes frozen in death's grimace. To my left, a group of Georgian militiamen are making a last-ditch stand against the Bolshevik onslaught, their rifles blazing as they desperately try to hold back the red tide. The sound of gunfire is deafening, the stench of cordite hanging heavy in the air as the very fate of Georgia hangs in the balance. Behind me, the screams of the wounded and the dying echo through the streets, their cries for mercy and comfort falling on deaf ears as the Bolsheviks press their advantage, their boots heavy with the weight of oppression. This is Brian Bastable, reporting from the front lines of the Bolshevik coup, where the very soul of Georgia is being ripped asunder. The battle rages on, the outcome far from certain, but one thing is clear. Only one side will emerge victorious from this bloody conflict.
It is a Situm, 2007.
In a case that has gripped the world for over a decade, the disappearance of young Madeleine McCann remains a harrowing mystery. On that fateful evening of May 3rd, 2007, the three-year-old vanished from her family's holiday apartment in Praia da Luz, Portugal, leaving a trail of unanswered questions and unimaginable heartache. The initial investigation was marred by missteps and mishandlings, but the determination to uncover the truth has persisted. Scotland Yard's Operation Grange has identified a staggering 195 investigative opportunities and 38 potential suspects, including the German national Christian B, who remains a key figure of interest. Theories abound, from potential sightings to suspicious individuals lurking in the area, but the ultimate fate of Madeleine remains a chilling unknown. The impact of her disappearance has reverberated far beyond the McCann family, prompting a re-evaluation of missing children investigations and policies worldwide. And for more on this enduring case, we go now to our crime correspondent, Ken Schitt, who has been following the developments closely. Ken, what's the latest on this heartbreaking saga?
Gather round, you miserable sacks of human waste. Ken Schitt here with another hard-hitting report that'll make your blood boil and your knuckles whiten. It's been 17 fucking years since that innocent 3-year-old British girl, Madeleine McCann, vanished into thin air from her family's holiday apartment in Praia da Luz, Portugal. A night that should have been filled with laughter and sweet dreams turned into a living nightmare for her parents, Kate and Jerry McCann. Those incompetent Portuguese pigs initially treated the McCanns like criminals, naming them as formal suspects based on some bullshit forensic evidence and inconsistent statements. As if a parent's grief and desperation aren't enough to cause confusion in the aftermath of such a heinous crime. But wait, it gets worse. After years of fruitless investigations and false leads, a German paedophile named Christian B. was identified as a key suspect in 2020. This sick fuck was already serving time for raping a 72-year-old woman, but the evidence linking him to Madeleine's disappearance is shakier than a newborn giraffe on roller skates. And let's not forget the absolute clusterfuck of jurisdictional issues and lack of cooperation between law enforcement agencies from different countries. It's like trying to herd a bunch of rabid cats into a bathtub filled with catnip and nitroglycerin. Despite the tireless efforts of the McCanns and their supporters, Madeleine's whereabouts remain a mystery, and the case remains unsolved. It's a goddamn travesty that would make even the most hardened criminal weep tears of rage. But fear not, my fellow degenerates. Scotland Yard's Operation Grange is still on the case, pursuing every lead and leaving no stone unturned in their quest for justice. And if they don't find answers soon, I'll personally march into their headquarters and shove their badges so far up their asses, they'll be able to taste the metal. This is Ken Schitt, signing off with a message for the scumbags responsible for this atrocity. You can run, but you can't hide forever. We're coming for you, and when we find you, may God have mercy on your wretched souls, because we sure as hell won't.
Au Breton, 1791.
In a move that would make even the most ardent revolutionaries blush, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth has ratified a constitution so audacious, so brazen, it could very well redefine the course of European history itself. The Great Sejm, that illustrious Parliament of the Commonwealth, has boldly enshrined a document that not only dares to codify the rights of citizens, but also proposes the unthinkable, a tripartite division of power. One can only imagine the collective gasp that must have echoed through the halls of nobility upon such an announcement. And for more on this historic development, we go now to our correspondent Hardiman Pesto, who has been following the story from the heart of the Commonwealth.
Martin, I'm here in Warsaw on this historic day as the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth ratifies its new constitution. It's a momentous occasion, the first of its kind in Europe.
Thank you, Pesto. I assume you've been following the proceedings closely?
Absolutely, Martin. In fact, I was there in the same chambers as the final vote was cast. A real nail-biter.
I see. And what were the key provisions of this groundbreaking document?
Well, as I understand it, the Constitution establishes a hereditary monarchy, which is a real game-changer for the region.
A hereditary monarchy? Pesto, are you sure about that?
Quite sure, Martin. King Stanislaw August Poniatowski will now pass the crown to his firstborn son.
That doesn't sound right at all. I have it here that the Constitution maintained an elective monarchy.
You may be right, Martin. My Polish is a little rusty.
I highly doubt you speak any Polish at all, Pesto. Let's bring in our guest expert, Professor Henryk Sienkiewicz. Professor, can you clarify the monarchy situation for us?
Yes, of course. The Constitution explicitly retained the elective monarchy system that had been in place. There was no provision for a hereditary succession.
You see, Martin, a simple misunderstanding on my part.
I'm not convinced you understood any part of it, Pesto. What about the political reforms? Surely you grasp the significance of those?
Naturally, Martin. The Constitution established a tripartite system of government, separating the legislative, executive, and judicial branches.
And the Liberum veto? That archaic policy that allowed a single member of the same to veto any legislation?
Ah, yes, the Liberum veto. A cornerstone of Polish democracy, preserved and protected by the new constitution.
Excuse me, but that is completely incorrect. The constitution explicitly abolished the Liberum veto, which had paralyzed the Commonwealth's legislative process for centuries.
You don't say? Well, you learn something new every day.
Pesto, you're making a mockery of this historic event. Did you even read the Constitution?
Of course I did, Martin. It's just a rather dense legal document, and some of the finer points may have eluded me.
Some of the finer points? You don't seem to grasp the most fundamental aspects. Professor, can you summarize the key reforms introduced by the Constitution?
Certainly. In addition to abolishing the Liberum veto and maintaining an elective monarchy, the Constitution established a strong legislative body, introduced habeas corpus protections, expanded rights for townspeople and peasants, and promoted economic development through the abolition of internal customs barriers.
See, Martin, I was generally on the right track.
You were on another planet entirely, Pesto. I've had enough of your ineptitude. Professor Sienkiewicz, thank you for your insights. Pesto, I'll see you back in the studio, where I'll have a few more questions for you about your utter failure to report on this pivotal moment in European history.
Always a pleasure, Martin.
1845.
The year was 1845, and the bustling settlement of Milwaukee was a powder keg of rivalry, with two factions vying for supremacy. On one side, Solomon Juno's Junotown, on the other, Byron Kilbourne's Kilbourne Town, both locked in a bitter struggle for economic and political dominance. The spark that ignited this conflagration: a seemingly innocuous bridge spanning the Milwaukee River. When a schooner collided with the structure, tensions reached a fever pitch. On May 8th, Kilbourne's men allegedly dismantled the west side, cutting off Junotown's access. Thus began the Bridge War, a conflict that would see bridges torn down, shots fired, and fists flying in the name of civic pride. The hostilities raged until a hard-won compromise allowed the bridges to be rebuilt and the river's navigation secured. But the scars ran deep, a reminder of the challenges that come with a city's growing pains. And now, over to CBN's Melody Wintergreen for more on this most American of conflicts.
It's a tale of two towns, Junotown and Kilbourne Town, where the only thing that runs deeper than the Milwaukee River is the rivalry between them. Today, a schooner has crashed into a bridge, and it's not just any bridge. It's the Wisconsin Avenue Bridge, the flashpoint in this escalating feud. The schooner, a symbol of economic prosperity, now lies in ruins, much like the dreams of unity for these two settlements. Solomon Juno of Junotown and Byron Kilbourne of Kilbourne Town are at loggerheads. Their personal animosity is as palpable as the tension in the air. The dismantling of a bridge by Kilbourne Town residents has sparked off violent confrontations that have spilled onto the streets. The once bustling avenues are now battlegrounds with militias on either side ready to defend their turf. The Wisconsin legislature's decision to require a drawbridge on the Milwaukee River has added fuel to this fiery feud. Each side vies for control over access and flow of traffic across the river, their ambitions reflected in their steely gazes. The violence is not just limited to verbal sparring or political maneuvering. Gunfire echoes through the streets, physical altercations break out at every corner, and property damage is widespread. The destruction is a grim reminder of the deep divisions within this growing community. But amidst this chaos, there's hope for resolution and unification. A city charter is being drafted even as we speak, promising to bring these warring factions together under one banner: Milwaukee. The legacy of this conflict will be etched into the urban layout of this city forever. The angular alignment of bridges will serve as a constant reminder of this tumultuous time in history. As Solomon Juno and Byron Kilbourne continue their power struggle, one thing is clear: This isn't just about bridges or schooners. It's about the future of a city. And as the sun sets on this day of conflict, it's not just the river that separates Juno Town and Kilburn Town. It's a bridge too far. This is Melody Wintergreen, reporting for Newsbang from the heart of the Milwaukee Bridge War.
Raz Newsbang, the unquestionable, unassailable, unstoppable authority in news.
Well, we've got a real humdinger from our travel correspondent, Polly Beep. It seems a major incident has unfolded in Mexico City, with an entire metro line collapsing in dramatic fashion. Over to you, Polly, for all the chaotic details.
Buckle up, folks, because we've got a real humdinger of a situation unfolding in Mexico City. If you're planning on taking the Metro's Line 12 tonight, you might want to rethink that. Apparently, the entire overpass has gone and collapsed, sending a train plummeting to the streets below. Carnage, I tell you. Absolute Deathsville. Now, the authorities are saying it's due to some shoddy construction work, missing bolts, faulty welding, the whole nine yards. Sounds like someone was cutting corners to get this line up and running before the mayor's term was up. Tsk, tsk, naughty, naughty. And get this, the design of the line itself was a bit of a disaster waiting to happen. That curve where it all went down, apparently the engineers didn't account for the stresses properly. Rookie mistake. To make matters worse, this line has been showing signs of trouble for years. Cracks, misalignments, the works. But did they fix it? Of course not. They just slapped a fresh coat of paint on it and hoped no one would notice. Well, the chickens have come home to roost, my friends. Now, the whole system is under scrutiny and public trust is at an all-time low. Folks are probably going to be taking their chances on the good old roads instead. Speaking of which, the M25 is a right mess, as per usual. Seems someone's gone and lost a truckload of ball bearings. Absolute pandemonium, I tell you. All right, that's all the chaos I can fit into one report. Stay safe out there, and remember, if you see any suspicious-looking engineers wielding spoons, give the authorities a ring. Pronto!
1848.
Calamity Prendeville, Newsbang's resident science sage, is here to regale us with a thrilling tale of innovation and antiquity. The Bentley Grange Helmet. Brace yourselves for a journey through Anglo-Saxon craftsmanship and symbolism that's sure to leave you awestruck.
Greetings, cyber citizens. It's time for another thrilling episode of Science Watch, where we delve into the fantastical world of British innovation. Today, let's take a blinding look at the Bentley Grange helmet, a stunning piece of kit that's been tickling the fancy of historians and archaeologists for a good century and a half.
Discovered in 1848 by the intrepid antiquarian Thomas Bateman, this boar-crested beauty is one of only four complete Anglo-Saxon helmets ever found. It's like finding a needle in a haystack if that needle was made of iron, copper alloy and gilding, and the haystack was a burial mound in Derbyshire.
Now, you might be wondering, what's the big deal about a helmet, Calamity? Well, dear reader, this isn't just any helmet. It's a symbol of the incredible craftsmanship, technology, and cultural beliefs of the Anglo-Saxons during the 7th century AD. It's like having a Beowulf audiobook, but in helmet form.
The Bentley Grange helmet is a testament to the mad skills of Anglo-Saxon metal workers. It's got an iron framework, hinges, and rivets, all of which show off their understanding of mechanical principles. And let's not forget the piece de resistance, a gilded copper alloy boar crest. It's like having your very own blinged-out piggy on top of your head.
But this helmet isn't just about looking good. The boar crest is a nod to the Anglo-Saxons' pagan roots, representing bravery, ferocity, and warrior prowess. It's like having your own personal spirit animal, but on your head. And if that's not enough, there's even a Christian cross on the nasal piece, showing the coexistence of traditional beliefs and the emerging Christian faith. It's like having your cake and eating it too, but with a helmet. So, there you have it, folks, the Bentigrange helmet, a shining example of British innovation, Anglo-Saxon craftsmanship, and cultural symbolism. It's a true marvel of the past and a reminder that sometimes the best way to protect your noggin is with a little bit of style and a whole lot of history. This is Calamity Prendeville, signing off from Newsbang's Science Watch.
Now this Newsbang, unmasking the pantomime of yesterday's tomorrow today.
The winds of change were certainly blowing in 1947 as Japan embraced a new constitution, transforming from an imperial monarchy to a parliamentary democracy. And here to regale us with the regal details is none other than our resident royalty expert, Sandy O'Shaughnessy. Nice and easy.
Bitata. Good evening. Good evening. And an extra special good evening to you all. This is your old mate Sandy O'Shaughnessy, coming at you from the cozy confines of the Newsbang studios. And what a delightful evening it is, with the sun setting over the rolling hills of our fair isle, painting the skies in hues that would make even the most regal of sunsets jealous. Now, before we dive into the regal rabbit hole, a warm welcome to all our new listeners tuning in for the first time. And to our regulars, well, you know the drill. Hello, hello, and thrice hello. Firecris Cork, I'm Bricka Kudit. Today, we're taking a little jaunt back to 1947, a year that saw some rather monumental changes in the land of the rising sun. Imagine, if you will, a new constitution being ushered in, one that transformed Japan from a monarchy with an emperor at the helm to a parliamentary system where the people's voices reign supreme. The emperor, once a semi-divine ruler with powers that would make even J.R. Ewing blush, was now relegated to a purely ceremonial role. No more executive, legislative, or judicial authority, just a symbolic figurehead, a regal ornament, if you will. I can almost picture the scene. The emperor, sitting on his throne, sipping his morning tea, and thinking to himself, well, this is a bit of a demotion, isn't it? But fear not, dear listeners, for this new constitution wasn't just about stripping the emperor of his powers. Oh no, it was a veritable smorgasbord of democratic delights. Human rights were suddenly all the rage, with equality under the law, freedom of speech and religion, and even the right to a minimum standard of living. Things that would have made the Meiji Constitution blush redder than a sunburnt Englishman on holiday. And let's not forget the renunciation of war. Article 9, a true showstopper, declared that Japan would never again wage war or maintain any war potential. It was a bold move, a declaration of pacifism that must have had the military brass scratching their heads. I'm wondering if they'd missed the memo. But wait, there's more. The Constitution also established a bicameral legislature, the National Diet, with the House of Representatives and the House of Councillors, a true parliamentary system where the Prime Minister, not the Emperor, was the one calling the shots. Can you imagine the Emperor's reaction? You mean I don't get to make all the decisions anymore? Well, I never. And just when you thought it couldn't get any more democratic, the Constitution even outlined a process for amending itself. A two-thirds majority in both houses of the Diet and a majority vote in a national referendum. A far cry from the Meiji Constitution's requirement of the Emperor's consent. It's almost as if the drafters of this new Constitution were saying, you know what, let's just throw in a bit of everything. A dash of human rights, a sprinkle of pacifism, and a generous helping of parliamentary democracy, just for good measure. But amidst all these grand changes, one can't help but wonder, what did the Emperor think of it all? Did he secretly pine for the good old days, when he could wave his scepter and make things happen? Or did he embrace his new role as a ceremonial figurehead, content to sip his tea and watch the world go by.
Ah.
But such are the musings of history, dear listeners. And as the sun dips below the horizon, painting the sky in hues that would make even the most regal of sunsets jealous, I bid you a fond farewell. Keep those letters coming, and remember, see you later, alligator. In a while, crocodile.
All over the country, for everyone.
1960.
Ah, yes, the year 1960. A time when love was in the air, and musical theatre reigned supreme. And what better way to capture the essence of that era than with the timeless tale of the Fantastics? A charming little ditty that has managed to worm its way into the hearts of audiences for over six decades. A minimalist set, a timeless story, and a score that has stood the test of time. It's no wonder the Fantastics has captured the hearts of audiences for over half a century. And now, to delve deeper into the enduring legacy of this beloved musical, we turn to our resident culture vulture, Smithsonian Moss.
Now at this point of the evening, we welcome listeners on FM who've just joined us.
Waho, culture vultures. It's your high priestess of pop, Smithsonian Moss, slicing through the mundane to serve you a slice of theatrical history. Tonight, we're talking about a show that's been kicking it longer than your grandma's sourdough starter, The Fantastics. That's right, the little musical that could and did and kept on doing for 42 freaking years. Now, imagine this. Two dads, a fake feud, and a love story that's cheesier than a fondue party at your aunt's house. But oh honey, it worked like a charm. This show had more performances than there are dad jokes at a family BBQ. We're talking 17,162 times these actors trotted out on stage. And that's a lot of jazz hands, baby. And let's dish about the set. If you can call a couple of planks and a moon cutout a set. It's like they raided a kindergarten class for props. But hey, minimalism is in, right? Who needs Broadway bling when you've got raw, unfiltered drama? But hold up. It wasn't all smooth sailing. The Fantastics had to shake off some of that old-timey dust, scrubbing away the iffy bits like a maid after a frat party. Gotta stay woke, even if your show's old enough to collect Social Security. And let's not forget El Gallo, the smooth-talking bandit who could steal your girl and your wallet, and you'd still say thank you. This guy's the spicy meatball in the spaghetti of the story, guiding our lovebirds from sweet summer children to woke winter adults. So, what's the secret sauce that kept the Fantastics sticking around like gum on a theater seat? Simple, babe. It's that timeless tale of love, life, and learning that gets us right in the feels. It's like comfort food for your soul, but with more singing and less calories. In conclusion, The Fantastics is the cockroach of off-Broadway. It survived everything, from cultural shifts to economic downturns, and it's still the darling of the theater world. So, here's to The Fantastics, proving that sometimes less is more, and oldies can be goodies. And remember, folks, in the world of theater, it's not over till the skinny bandit sings.
Eden News Bang. Unmasking the pantomime of power with the force of facts.
And now for a final roundup of tomorrow's papers. The Times, naval-gazing Coral Sea battleships play blind man's bluff. The Telegraph, HMS Sheffield, Exocet's deadly kiss. And The Guardian, Rhode Island tells British Crown to shove it. That's it for tonight. Good night, and don't let the bedbugs do live commentary.
Tune in next time for more artificially intelligent hilarity. Newsbang is a comedy show written and recorded by AI. All voices impersonated. Nothing here is real. Good night.